I'm Sandy Beach and I'm an alcoholic. Let's start out with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, it's a real honor to be asked to spend an hour with you all, or 45 minutes or whatever, just talking a little bit about some of the important spiritual principles in Alcoholics Anonymous. And before I do that, I always like to say that if anything I say is at odds with what your sponsor is telling you, then you go with your sponsor. Things change as time goes on, and what I saw 25 years ago, it's different what I see now, and all we can ever report is what we see at the present moment. What does it look like? And somebody asks you, what do you think about this? And you just have a different perspective. And it's not that your old perspective was wrong. It's just that this is more right. It's just a higher level of truth. So it's, you don't have to be embarrassed when you find something that reaches you at a deeper level. You just simply be glad for it. And you'll find as your sobriety moves on that you will have these periods where you suddenly see things quite a bit differently. And I had little ones along the way, but at 39 years, it was like between 39 and 41, it was like I got everything changed. So it never stops, and it's very exciting to have those things happen. One of my favorite authors to read is Ernie Kurtz, who wrote the best history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had a way of describing AA that I just love, and everywhere I go, I try to share it. And he said that in an almost magical manner, Alcoholics Anonymous managed to present to their religious members and non-religious members alike, a view of the universe and their place in it, which is both exciting and comforting. In doing this, they borrowed from religion everything that was comforting and self-supporting, and politely declined everything that was self-serving and conflicting. He said, you might call it the spiritual heist of the century. And AA did it unconsciously without realizing they were doing it. It just happened. And that's what I love about spirituality. It's something that can't be figured out, but when it happens, you know it. And so I like to think about the origin of AA in a spiritual sense. And everybody loves the scientific, and so I like to think about when they finally decided the universe started with the Big Bang, that I'm going to come up with what the Big Bang was for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think there's three choices, and I'm sure in the room we'd get votes for all three. One was when Ebby came to see Bill, and Bill saw this spiritual transformation in front of his eyes. The other one was when he was in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel and suddenly realized he better call another alcoholic. And the third one is Bill's spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital, and that's the one I vote for because I'm running the panel today, so. That's the one I'm going to use. Because prior to that moment, and that's what we're talking about today, is the moment. Prior to that moment, there was no hope for alcoholics in the world. They were going to go insane. They were going to die out in the streets. It was going to be bad news. And in that moment, Bill Wilson experienced a personal transformation that set him free from alcohol. And together with it, an absolute obsession or compulsion to go out and save every alcoholic in the world and show them how to have the same kind of spiritual experience. And it was so strong inside of him that nothing ever got in his way. And when you study history in AA and realize what he went through in those early years of being broke, being evicted from their house, having no money, living in 70 different AA people's homes, borrowing cars, traveling around the country, getting this thing started, you got to realize that there was something powerful pushing him. And that was part of the spiritual awakening. And we find in our own lives that as we have this transformation, we're eagerly looking for some newcomer. We just love the idea of passing on what we have to someone else and then watching them be transformed. That's a pretty high-level life experience, is to see someone else experience their own creator. And so we could say that this moment, this big bang, occurred 76 and a half years ago, or we could say it's still happening. And that's what I like to think about. In other words, your sobriety and my sobriety was contained right in that moment. It was all in there, and now it's unfolding, and it finally reached out to you and I. But the energy and the whole manner in which this happened occurred in that moment. And when you have these type of moments in Alcoholics Anonymous, they really are very powerful, and they make us appreciate the present a lot more than we used to. And so the trick is, how do you get there? You know, how do you know? It's okay, everybody says that living in the present would really be the most comfortable thing to do, so why don't we all do it? And we have a variety of answers depending on where you are at the present time. One of them is, I'm too busy. Mine was, I don't have enough money to hang around in the present moment. I got stuff to do, man. That's something for older people. They can sit around and do that kind of stuff. But when you've got six kids, you can't be, you know, that's just too off the wall. So I would say that one of the things that is essential is, similar to step three, is the decision to try and do it. You don't sit around and wait for it to happen. It's a decision. I'm going to decide to find out how I can be much more in the present moment than I am now. So it's almost like making a decision to seek God, to become a seeker. When you do that, when you are in the 11th step and you actually go to a meditation class or you go buy books on meditation, you decide personally, this is not a group function, this is an individual action. Both the big book and the 12 and 12 say in the 11th step that these are individual actions. We can have wonderful teachers like Howard, but you got to end up doing it yourself. And that requires a commitment and a realization that that's where all the answers and where your happiness lies, is in that moment. And so I think making a decision to raise it up to a much higher priority than it was in your life is really a big part of it. And another similarity to spirituality is this. When we find out that we get forced in here to AA and we're confronted with this spiritual program that we don't understand, but we don't have anywhere else to go, so we're going to take steps that we don't believe in, and then we're amazed when they work. At first we think it's a coincidence, but eventually they're too powerful and we start realizing maybe there is something other than me that can help me and that I can become aware of, etc. And we realize that the steps don't teach us anything. They get us there by causing us to get rid of things, get rid of baggage that we're carrying around, get rid of old ideas. The whole process in the early steps is to get rid of, list all these things, and then when we get with our sponsor, we see that we're seeing it wrong. I'll never forget that thing. You go through the fourth step. I'm really careful, I'm thoughtful, I'm writing it all out, and then he said, I see rationalizations on here. Yes, I'm guilty of that, I really rationalize. Well, then how do we know anything on this paper is worth anything? So then we looked at it through his eyes and my eyes, and everything could be seen differently. So when he asked me what my part was and I didn't know, he helped me. And then I went, oh, yeah. I'm sick of saying that to my sponsor. Oh, yeah. When does he say, oh, yeah, back to me? Never happens. So we can see that in the very beginning, we realize that for some unknown reason, being wrong is where it's at. Wow, wrong again. Wrong again. And we get to the point where Chuck Chamberlain just loved to find something else he was wrong about so he could get rid of it after all those years. And to just go, wow, there's a wrong idea lurking around down in here. It's like finding another sliver that it's been irritating you, but you didn't know exactly where it was. And finally, here it is. So one less irritant in our peace is getting rid of something that simply isn't true. There was an old guy in D.C., Charlie Bruton. He was, he's been dead a long time, but he was I think the counsel for the House of Representatives from Alabama, and he had all these funny sayings. He hid his alcohol in his tie in miniatures. So he'd come in, and his wife would pat him down, and she never thought of looking in his tie, and he had these miniatures in there. And I forget when it was, in the 70s or somewhere, where they started coming out with real wide ties. And he said, where the heck were those ties back when I was drinking? But he had these, he was the one, here I am telling Charlie Bruton's jokes. He's the one that a new guy came up to Charlie, and he was very agitated throughout the whole meeting. Couldn't concentrate, couldn't sit on his chair, and he came up and he said, sir, I just want to report that the clock in the back of the room says 9:15, and the clock in the front of the room says 8:30. And Charlie didn't miss a beat. He looked him right in the eye and said, if they both said the same time, we wouldn't need but one clock. Which left the newcomer speechless. But Charlie always used to like to point out that it isn't the things you don't know that kill you. It's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And that's what we were sure of things. You remember that? Even when it was pointed out it was wrong. Well, maybe it's wrong, but I'm going to keep it. It's something about pride of authorship that kept us from the real freedom that we can enjoy here. I know I'm in jail, but I got here. It was my doing. And maybe I'll write a book someday, and jail experiences could benefit me. So it's not a total mistake that I'm here in jail. You remember, we just could rationalize anything. Howard did such a job on that yesterday. God, that was funny. How that mind works. And the funny thing is, as he was going along, everybody in the room just going, yeah, you know, like, amazing. So I'm reminded of the 12 and 12 when it's talking about the third step, and the idea is offered that we should turn our will and our life over to the care of God, and the response is, well, if I do that, I'll become a non-entity. I'll become the hole in the donut. And if you want to be in the now, you have to be a non-entity. There isn't room for all of your beliefs and ideas and goals and your judgments, your opinions. They won't fit in there. So if you want to go in there, you're going to have to abandon them. You're going to have to abandon so that you can experience something. And this is very difficult because we live in the material world, and probably 90% of our time we are influenced by newspapers and TV and advertising, and they're hammering into us the golden rules of the material world because they know that everyone wants happiness, and each person has a product that'll make you happy if you'll just buy it. And so we're bombarded with the plan. And we're also bombarded with, you're the one, nobody else will live your life for you, it's up to you to succeed, you have to be the one to go out there, you have to be a which is true. If you study hard, you get high grades. If you work hard, you'll get promoted. Those are all true. And you could follow the plan and become the president of the company. What they left out is, even that doesn't make you happy. Well, why am I working so hard? I thought I was this close to being at peace with myself. One more thing. One more marriage. One more, you name it. One more running 10 marathons in an hour. Whatever your obsession is, if I could push this a little further. And they all are dead ends. And generally, we have to learn the hard way by exploring every alternative to God before we come back up. What's this God stuff? Do you follow what I'm saying? We just are going to figure it out on our own. So when it suggests that we... I don't know why I've always loved the first line in the 12 and 12. I don't know if anybody remembers it. Who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one. See, complete defeat is unconditional surrender. Unconditional. And we've heard a little bit about how that works. We do that until we get the pressure off our back, and then we put conditions on our surrender. You remember that? When we first got to AA, I'll do anything my sponsor, anything. You'll do anything for, anything for sobriety. A couple months later, I'll do a lot for sobriety. I'll do a lot. So the tendency to try and figure life out doesn't go away easily. And if we want to get into the present moment, we have to abandon trying to figure life out. We have to totally abandon it because it doesn't work. When have you ever figured something out and you go, wow, got it? And then an hour later, so what good did it do you? I don't know, but I got it. I'm very, very restless, irritable, and discontent, but I know precisely why. So that's a big plus. And, well, it may be, but it's not in terms of making spiritual progress. So I've thought about this for a long time, and I still haven't found any reason to not continue saying it, that the entire program can be summarized as let go and let God. And all of our steps are designed to pry our life out of our hands. And we have this grip on life, and because alcohol almost killed us, we're willing to let go of that one finger and let alcohol go, but we still have a death grip on all other areas in my life. And as we confront step 6 and 7, where they want us to open all fingers, let everything, give up the entire management of your own life, give up your judgment of what should be done. Well, don't you think that's a little extreme? Don't you think perhaps? And then we come up with this thing. If, you know, you have to live in the world, you have to earn a living, you have to. We just race ahead rather than try it. In other words, in order to make a judgment about something like that, you have to actually try it. How many people have come to AA? I meet them all the time. Fortunately, they come back later. And they're sent here. And they sit there, and they are not going to let AA in, come hell or high water. You've seen that resistance. Well, we've been given free will. We can block the power of AA from coming in. So you stay here for 90 days, and you leave, and you say AA doesn't work. And it's true. It doesn't. Didn't work for you at all because you didn't let it. And so the same thing happens with totally letting go. It is so frightening. It is so against our basic material nature that it looks like it probably we shouldn't even try it. And so it is generally through pain, unfortunately, that we let go of something else. Instead of using humility, we rely on humiliation. And finally, we just get so embarrassed and we go, okay, all right, I will give that up. Oh, wow. And then later on, reaping the rewards of being humiliated, we take credit for it. Well, I saw that porn was really ruining my life, so I decided to give it up. Is that really accurate? Well, maybe I had a little pressure from the family, the doctors, and all these things. Or I finally tore up my credit cards. Finally tore them up. Was it you that tore them up? Well, actually, it was my wife who tore them up, but I went along with it. And so you can see that the progress that we're making is against our own better judgment. We were forced into it, just like we were forced into coming into AA. And so Bill writes in the 12 and 12 that a great turning point, I love that word, a great turning point, occurs when we see humility as something we want rather than something we have to have. And now we're going to push ourselves into attempting to let go as absolutely as we can. Which leads us inevitably to meditation, to reading about, I read a lot of spiritual literature, to understand that there's another reality beyond my thoughts. And I can't get there unless I get quiet I cannot experience this fourth dimension of existence that Bill Wilson talks about unless I'm quiet. And in order to get there, I have to give up stuff that I rely on to keep me excited, because that's what I am addicted to. I need stimulus. You know, I want to watch TV. I want to go do this. I want to be busy. I can't just sit still. Be still and know that I am there. I believe that, but I'm a little busy now about getting still. Getting still is, I don't know. I think that's for a different type of people than me. And everyone who has succeeded in that area and found great comfort in it was just like the rest of us. So there isn't anybody who is more inclined to be able to do these things. It is a decision. And again, the decision will come from pain, or it could come from attraction, where you talk and meet and you're around people who have come closer to this existence in the present moment. And, as the old saying goes, you want what they have. You want what they have. And I know that I would love to just stand in the same room with the Dalai Lama so that I could have the energy just come and I could experience it. I don't even have to have a conversation. I just want to get the energy, because I honestly believe it's there and can be experienced. So you can see a lot of it has to do with opening our mind to these things. We had a lot of closed mind issues when we got here. I think one of the greatest things about AA that, unfortunately, I think we're screwing up a little bit, but that's just my own opinion, and that is we are people who don't ordinarily mix. That, to me, is real AA. People who don't ordinarily mix. Unfortunately, there's been a tendency to re-divide us up into groups that do ordinarily mix. And I don't know why. I don't think that serves any purpose myself. Because if we're with other people who are just like us, we're going to still be afraid of different people. We are not going to be as comfortable. I'm more comfortable with my own kind. What the hell is your own kind? How about a child of God? How about a human being? And so my surprise when I came here, I had so many prejudices you wouldn't believe. I mean, I sat in that first meeting up in Manassas after my head cleared, and I looked around the room, and there's a bunch of hillbillies in there. I mean, these guys were playing fiddle and square dancing. Then there were people from the South. You know, I grew up in New England. All of the intelligence was in New England. You didn't know that years ago. Yeah, it was all there. None of it was on the West Coast, I can tell you that right now. So as I looked around the room, there wasn't many people I was going to listen to. What could that guy possibly teach me? What could he possibly... Look at him. He's wearing freaking overalls. You know. It's just... And then he'd say something, and I'd go, holy cow, where the hell did he get that? Then I found myself asking him questions. You all must have experienced some of this. And you're over there, and you're just going, Fred, I got another question. Fred, all of a sudden, he's the source of all kinds of wisdom, and you realized you were wrong. You were wrong about that, wrong about this, wrong about that. And your mind kept opening and opening. And it's because we were thrust into a room full of people who don't ordinarily mix. And we had that tremendous experience. So what happened just in that little group? Look how many things I was wrong about that I got rid of. And remember we said, wrong information, wrong ideas prevent us from moving ahead spiritually. They are blocking us. In other words, as we move ahead, let's just imagine that the hallway gets narrower. We're going to have to get rid of something if we want to keep moving ahead. We're going to have to get rid of more. And so the farther we go, the more we're going to, of ourselves, we're going to have to give up. And in the beginning, it seems like damage is being done. It seems like this is, I don't know, I'm very uncomfortable with what's going on. But then we get the rewards of it in terms of peace of mind. We're able to sleep at night, and we suddenly start changing our mind about spiritual pain. Bill makes a big deal about that in Step 7 and the 12 and 12, that we're going to have to come to grips with pain. And when we come to grips with it, it isn't pain anymore. We change our whole attitude towards it, and it becomes something akin to effort. It was pain because we didn't want to do it. It sometimes reminds me of, you get out of shape, now you're going to go back and get in shape. And you remember the same workout you used to do, now when you go home that night, every muscle in your body hurts. You are in a lot of pain. But you know if you keep it up, that pain will go away and you'll be able to work out and feel healthy, and you will reclassify it as a workout, as I'm going running, I'm going whatever it is. And you are maintaining this condition and you don't see it as painful at all. And the same thing happens when we push ourselves spiritually to abandon more of our territory. I've always liked that analogy that we all live in our own little world. You ever heard that one? We all live in our own little world. And sometimes we say it derogatorily about somebody. You know Alice. She lives in her own little world. Well, so do you. And so do you. And so does everybody in this room. And if there's 6.7 billion people on planet Earth, there's 6.7 own little worlds. And then the scientist says, yes, but in addition to that, there's the real world. And the answer is, well, maybe there is, but no one lived there. So, to be in the now, we're going to have to concede a lot of territory. We are going, so if you imagine that when you come into AA, your territory is the United States. It's yours. I own the United States. That's what I lay claim to. And because of your alcoholism, you have to give up Florida and Georgia, or you're going to die. Okay, I'll give up Florida and Georgia, but I'm never giving up Texas. I'll tell you that. I'm not giving that up. And then you find out that unless you give up Texas, you're also going to die. It was like when my sponsor told me I was going to have to give up embezzling. I was taking cash at work in the Marine Corps, and he said, they'll charge you with embezzling. You can't stay sober in AA and continue to embezzle. I said, okay, so it's a two-step program. No drinking, no embezzling. And then he said, now look, if you're going to have a good marriage, you can't have any girlfriends. Oh, so there's three things you have to give up in AA. No embezzling, no drinking, no girlfriend. And then every month, get rid of this. No, you can't stay sober if you're going to do that. Pretty soon, They want you to give up the whole United States. I can't even keep Rhode Island. Couldn't I just keep Rhode Island? No, you can't get in the now with Rhode Island. Jesus. Well, I'll get close to the now. I'll get close to the... we start compromising. The whole sixth step in the 12 and 12 is a comedy routine on compromising. On spiritual values. I'll settle for as much spiritual progress as will get me by. You remember that line? I don't want to be trapped into being honest, but I want an honest reputation so people do business with me. So we see ourselves resisting perfection. Resisting it. And this is where Bill... It's the only inconsistency I ever found in any of the AA literature is between... I can't find anything in the big book or the 12 and 12 itself, but I would submit that perhaps the big book says progress, not perfection, and the 12 and 12 says progress towards perfection. Suddenly, Brill is introducing the concept in step 6 that we have to raise our eyes towards perfection, knowing that we'll never get there. But we're willing to try. And that's quite a commitment, to devote your entire life to trying to get something you know ahead of time you can't get. But you're going to get as close as you can. I'm going to get as close to what? As close to your Creator. That's the point of the whole thing. Sometimes I think that the great prodigal son and prodigal daughter, either way, is one of the greatest stories ever told. And, of course, everything in the spiritual world has to be done through stories. There's no facts. You can't do it scientifically. So we do it through fables, analogies, stories, etc. Which is, what's an AA meeting? My story is divided into three parts. What it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And then they tell the story. And you go, well, geez, just tell them the story. What is that? Well, supposing that some university came to me and said, how well do the 12 steps work? I'd like you to submit a paper on the results of the 12 steps. Can you do that? Can you give us a paper on how the 12 steps? And I said, well, I can't give you a paper, but I think I can prove it to you very easily if you will take the time. Yeah, I'll be glad to take. Fine, sit here. I'm going to ask everyone in this room to tell you their story. And when they all finish, you will have all the proof you need that these 12 steps work. And you and I know that he'll leave before we're halfway through. He'll see it. Hopeless, impossible situation. Did the steps, encountered my spiritual power, I'm transformed. And his own eyes tell him that you've been transformed. How much more proof? But it wasn't done on a scientific paper. It was done by telling stories. So that's AA. It is our story. So if you're new, you want to get interested in AA story. History. History is a very essential thing. There's Ernie Kurtz quoted somebody as saying that if you don't have a sense of history, you have no hope. It's a very important part. We have a little, accidentally, we started a little history meeting in Tampa. Just by accident. It was a discussion meeting that was too small. And we kept running out of stuff to talk about. So we said, well, each person will come up with a topic, and then you talk for 10 minutes on the topic, and then we'll talk about it. And the first person came in, talked about Sister Ignatia. And we all went, God, that was so cool. And she's the one that started the chips that are being handed out and all the drunks that came in and this and that. So from then on, we just said, well, it doesn't matter how new you are, you just raise your hand, and then next week you're going to come in with a little tidbit of history that you looked up online, and then you give a little report, and then everybody talks about it. And the miracle that it's working, it's giving new people an interest in history. And they see how much fun it is. And as you look, remember we said that if we had everyone tell their story in here, to the scientists, it would be the conclusive proof that the 12 steps work. As you study AA's history, you see the hand of God. It just comes out. It just is there. Nothing that the founders planned ever turned out. We're going to need a lot of money. We need a chain of drunk tanks. We need paid missionaries. We're going to go to Rockefeller. We're going to get all this money. No, that's not the way it's going to work at all. I'm sorry, you're wrong. We're going to do it this way. And so you see, AA just happened. And you can't go beyond that. There's no other way of explaining AA. It just happened. How did it happen? My story of how it happened, there was a big bang. And all the rest came out of that. Now you can come up with your own version of that, but you see the importance of a story. And so the prodigal son and daughter story is so typical of our situation that we start with a loving father who offers us everything, and we decide we can improve on that. And we go off on our own. And some of us really do, but then something happens, and we crash and burn, and we raise our handkerchief and surrender. And we find that we're not going to someplace new. We're coming to someplace that is vaguely familiar. We are coming back home. And as we are willing to let go of ourselves, our judgments, our opinions, and all of that, we can get closer to home as we engage in meditation, as we engage in contemplation, as we engage in reflection, as we read spiritual materials. We keep getting the sense of the familiar. Some of this, it turns out that Carl Jung really had it right when he said that alcoholism, the disease that alcoholics have, is a low-level thirst for God. And that inside of us was something that would not be quiet. And we tried to quiet it. We tried to find, what is it that's missing inside of me? Enough money, more sex, more power, something, attention. And no matter how much we achieved, it didn't quiet it. And someone said, well, maybe it's God. No, I'm in here. I can tell you that. That's not even close. That's not even close. Nobody wanted to hear about it. I didn't want to hear prayer. I didn't want to hear any of that stuff when I came in here. No. I went 5 years without saying the word God. I said, higher power. I went out of my way to carefully enunciate, well, my higher power. And then I realized you could say God faster than higher power. And I went on an efficiency kick. I said, okay, I'll use the word. So sometimes there's a lot of confusion about that word, God, when new people come to AA. And I think the problem is this. If you're a new person sitting out there and you hear me say, well, God did this for me, you decide for me what I mean when I say the word God, and you don't like it. Do you follow what I'm saying? That's called creating your own problem. You didn't ask me what I meant when I used the word. You decided for me what I meant, and you didn't like that. So that causes a lot of problems. So you should come and ask us, what do you mean when you say that word? And I would say to you, well, in the beginning, it was just a three-letter word that rhymed with odd. I didn't have a meaning. For me personally, it meant nothing. If you have put a lie detector on my arm and said, do you have any experience with God? I would have said no, and I would have registered telling the truth. I had no relation, nothing, zero. So it meant nothing to me. But I could tell in AA it meant something to these other people. I had to concede that. They were nuts about this word. And they weren't going to church. They had some other thing that they were doing with the word. And they told me that if I had an open mind and followed these steps, I would have an experience. It's called a profound personality change, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, whatever it is. And after I had that experience, I would have to explain it to myself. What was that? What just happened to me? So now we're talking about an experience. And because of that experience, I said to myself, so this is the God they're talking about. So in AA, it's the experience that you have that constitutes the meaning. And it's an individual experience, so it's different for everyone. Even though many of our members end up going back to the church they came from or whatever. Many don't. But in terms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is no official meaning of this word. It's the best word we can come up with to describe the power behind the experience. So you can't make a judgment about it until you have the experience. And you can't have the experience unless you have an open mind about trying it. And I realized why I didn't want to try it. It was the same reason I didn't want to pray. What if it worked? I'm going to look like a jerk. I've been bad-mouthing this stuff all my life. If I go home and pray and get happy, I'm not going to tell them. I'll be damned if I'm going to tell them that I went home and prayed and it worked. So you... So you can see that the whole program is preparing us to come into this sacred place. I mean, the now could be called the Promised Land. It is the place where all of the pain and fear of human existence is gone. And if we can learn to stay there, more and more, the importance of things start to disappear. They just start, and you suddenly realize, why was I so worked up about that? Why did I really care that we had decaf coffee or not? I voted against it for 5 years, and now I don't understand what the hell was wrong with me. Whatever, I wanted to assert Rhode Island. That's what I was doing. I didn't want to give up and surrender completely. I wanted to keep some of my territory. And every so often that ego raises its hand and said, no, I don't think we should have a picnic in our group. Really? I thought you'd like, no, I don't want us to have a picnic. And you go, why? I just want to block something. Anybody ever been in service? Oh, I'm sorry. Just want to block something. So anyway, we're getting at the end of the time. As you can see, there's no simple answer, but there's a simple solution. And if you leave here today, you're the one who's going to make the decision to take it to a higher level. You are. And if you do, and you do follow up on it, you are going to be so pleased with yourself that you did that. And if one person in here does that, then we've had a successful morning. I thank everybody for your attention, and we're going to stand and say the Lord's Prayer, and that'll wrap it up. Thank you all very much.